Think on your feet for our Fast and Curious 5K, a one-of-a-kind race hosted by WBEZ and the Chicago Sun-Times on Saturday, July 27th at Humboldt Park. More info and early bird registration at wbez.org/events.
You're listening to Nerdette Recaps Game of Thrones with Peter Sagal. I am Greta Johnson, and nobody else is here. But that's because Trisha and Peter and I recorded this episode live at an event at the Apple Store here in Chicago last week. We're going to play that conversation for you right now. But if you are one of those kinds of people who really loves a good conversation outline before we get started, you are welcome. Now that this whole damn show is over, we're going to talk about our feelings. We're going to do like a little emotional check-in. We'll talk about some of our favorite moments. We're also going to talk about the future of the books, if there are any books to speak of. And, of course, we will discuss how now we are going to fill that dragon-shaped hole in our hearts.
Hello, nerds.
This is exciting. I've never worked retail before, so this is...
All right, well, shall we get started?
Let's do it.
You're listening to Nerdette Recaps Game of Thrones with Peter Sagal. I'm Greta Johnson.
I'm Trisha Bobita, and this, of course, is Peter Sagal.
I am here for the last time. And it's sad.
Yeah.
I think I said this in the podcast for the third or fourth episode. I was like, I was ready to be done.
Yeah.
And that was part exhaustion. And that was also just sort
of
acceptance.
It's hard work watching television.
Well, it is. It's tough. Thinking of something funny to say about it.
We looked it up today, and bingeclock.com, which turns out is a website, says that all of Game of Thrones takes 72 hours and 34 minutes to watch.
But if you rewatch it, then it's a whole life's work.
I think, honestly, what I find really exciting is that this show is over, but it's proven that people have an appetite for dragons, especially people who thought they might not be interested in sci-fi and fantasy. And I think, as we'll talk about later on, there are so many new exciting things coming out that are so much more interesting when it comes to things like diversity and inclusion. And that's what I love that we've learned so much with Game of Thrones that we can like apply moving forward, and I think that's really cool.
I think we'll get to this later, but it feels like one of the people who's definitely learned this is Amazon, because they have ordered up a whole slew of sort of classic and beloved sci-fi and fantasy series into television. So they're trying to get in on this Game of Thrones sort of gravy train.
Yeah. I mean, I think everybody is, right? Like, it was a huge, 19 million people watched the finale? Like, what do you do with that, you know?
Somebody pointed out to me that figure, 19 million, which is a record for HBO, is about a third of the number who watch a typical regular season football game.
Yeah.
So.
We still have a ways to go.
Apparently.
All right, so favorite moments?
Oh my gosh, we want to do favorite moments of the whole series.
I mean, should we do season 8 just to make it a little easier?
I don't know. I mean, we're here to wrap up the whole thing.
We are.
What most interests me now that it's all over is, why did it happen? And I don't mean, you know, why did they put on the TV show? What made it into this amazing cultural phenomena?
Yeah.
And have there been others? I mean, I missed out. Like, I was not a Seinfeld fan. I basically stopped watching television for the 90s. I don't remember what I did instead. So I missed out on Seinfeld. I was kind of into The Sopranos. I was into The Sopranos when that happened. But even that didn't have this huge cultural thing. I mean, like, the New York Times, after every episode, the last season, had 6 different articles about it, speculating on this. I mean, just the coffee cup thing had 3 articles. And I just can't, I mean, so we all know that happened. You're all here on a beautiful Friday evening to listen to us talk about this TV show. I don't need to tell you this. What made it that? And so here's the first question. When did it go from just another premium cable show to phenomenon? Was there a moment? Was there an episode?
I think I read something where the head of HBO recently was saying that early on, maybe in season 1, there was a headline, something like, you know, this Game of Thrones is no Boardwalk Empire.
Meaning it wasn't as good as Boardwalk Empire.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, is a very fine TV show.
Right.
But like, I was never bestirred to do a podcast about it.
The first New York Times review that came out was like, oh yeah, no, it's fine, but don't bother.
Do you know what's interesting? That whatever the reviewers were saying, the show was renewed for a second season after the broadcast of the first episode.
Huh.
So HBO knew. whoever else didn't. So what was a lot of one speculation might be the Red Wedding, because I remember when the Red Wedding happened and everybody was posting those videos, the people who had read
reactions.
The books and knew it was about to happen just sort of sat there and videoed their friends watching it. And that, I mean, it wasn't the first time beloved characters got killed, but it was like by that time enough people were watching it and it was so insanely bloody and unexpected that people were like, holy shit. And you know, if there's one, if you want to talk about a favorite moment, I was just thinking about it. One of them is not the Red Wedding. I think it would be a heartless thing to say that's a favorite moment. But the fade to black slashes Catelyn's throat. She falls to the ground. Credits. That was spooky.
What about you, Trisha?
I've been doing a rewatch alongside watching this last season.
Yeah,
and
where are you in that right now?
I'm partway through season 5 in the rewatch, so made pretty good progress, which season 5 actually is the first season we recap together, right? So we've sort of caught up to that loop. And I really love some of the early season 1 Varys and Littlefinger scheming stuff. I love the scheming. I love the sort of people adjacent to power characters. I find them more interesting than the ones who have some birthright or think of themselves as the hero of the story. I did notice that Peter Baelish's voice gets progressively raspier as Littlefinger. As this, I've been binge rewatching, like that was sort of making me laugh.
Right before he was killed in season 7, if he had gone, and then talked in a totally normal voice. Don't kill me.
He just hadn't cleared his throat in 6 years.
Yeah, he was like, by the time he ended, he was
I think the scene where Sansa lies about how her aunt was killed to save Littlefinger and her from the Lords of the Vale is, I think, one of the greatest Sansa Stark moments of all time, where she breaks down crying and says she's going to tell the truth, and then she tells a story that's just true enough, but is actually to keep her and Littlefinger out of trouble. And then, like, there's this moment where she's getting a hug and she just stares at Littlefinger like, I have learned how to play this game.
Which she actually says
it's
to
so
him later
good.
On. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
How about you, Greta? What is a favorite moment?
That's a great segue, because I think my favorite is when we realize that Sansa and Arya have actually been working together and are ready to take Littlefinger down. I think it was so exciting to finally see people starting to come together towards the end of season 7. People had been in so many disparate locations for so long that actually getting everybody in the room was just so exciting, and especially seeing Arya come home.
Did you not have a favorite moment from any of the first 6 seasons?
No, I did not. No.
All right, I think
you will recall, Peter, I was going to stop watching after season 4. I was over the show. And that just happened to me.
Why were you over the show?
I just thought it was boring. I mean, I think I said that a lot while recapping season 5.
But you have more like nerd fantasy cred than anybody I know, right?
Thank you.
So you've read every book and all this.
All the books.
You've read all the books. So here's like the most successful fantasy TV show of all time. Why did you give up on it?
It felt mercilessly violent and not compelling enough to keep going with, you know? Like, I mean, I would always joke that I felt like with Game of Thrones, it was good if you could binge it because something was bound to happen if you watched 3 or 4 episodes in a row.
Yeah.
But I mean, as incremental TV, especially early on, I mean, that pacing was slow.
Oh, there was those long episodes, that long spate of episodes where it seemed like, oh, now we'll be at the Wall for 5 minutes and we'll have one conversation. And then we'll go to Meereen. And then we'll go back to King's Landing. And then we'll go here. And it's like each story gets propelled. Like, for example, I've been rewatching, and I didn't realize this. At the end of season 1, Jon goes with a ranging beyond the Wall. By the end of season 2, he's not back over it yet.
Yeah, man.
And then they get into season. And so it takes, like, the entire part of, like, Jon going up in the Wall with a Greet and hanging out with Tormund. That's an entire season.
Yeah.
So, yes, it didn't move at a lightning pace
in
those days.
And I think, especially those early days, that was also when I was enjoying shows like Scandal, which had very fast plots and crazy shit happened all the time. And it was like, I don't know, I think partly too, it's just sort of what I wanted to spend my time doing was not watching people talk to each other on horses and then die eventually.
That is what I wanted to be doing.
I know.
Why do you think then it became a global phenomenon? What was it about this show and not, say, Scandal? Boardwalk Empire, perfectly fine TV show.
I don't know. I mean, I did. I got to go on the BBC last week to talk about Game of Thrones.
Oh, you did.
Yeah, they did a segment about the petition that we talked about in last week's episode. There was a petition online for competent showrunners to rewrite season 8, and so I was invited on to talk about that.
Which is rude.
It is. It's super rude. And it was actually really great because I was on the show with a woman from South Africa who has a recap, a Game of Thrones recap podcast, and a woman in Sweden who has a Game of Thrones recap podcast. And the BBC host asked them what they thought was so special about Game of Thrones, and the woman in Sweden said, well, it's tits and dragons. And I just love that. I mean, I'm sure the nudity helped, right?
Yeah, there's actually
like
a
that
video
HBO
of
treatment
like, of Maisie Williams dancing around singing boobs and dragons, boobs
yeah,
and dragons.
Yeah, it's real, you yeah. know? But I mean, I don't know. I like to think that what the TV show did was invite a lot of people who thought fantasy wasn't for them realize that you could have some of the richest, most fascinating characters yeah. in a world that also allows for dragons.
I think, too, that the tipping point of cultural relevance is sort of like the FOMO moment,
yeah.
where if enough people in your office were chatting about it, then you figured, what the heck? And that sort of snowballs. And again, it's, you know, an HBO-length season of a show is short enough that to binge between the years of this show coming on, there were such short seasons with so much time in between, people had time to sort of accumulate year over year and be caught up.
Is it also true that in the run of Game of Thrones, the last 10 years, sometime in the last 3 or 4 years is when it became possible to binge? Because when the Game of Thrones started, I don't even know if there was an online Netflix.
Well, yet. Yeah. Well, and even then, I mean, even within like the HBO platforms, HBO Now
yeah.
or HBO Go are only, what, 2 years old?
So in order
like
to
you
binge,
had to have
in order
HBO.
To catch up with something. I mean, for example,
sure.
I remember I was late to Breaking Bad, and I caught up in the last season, and I loved it. But in order to catch up, I had to buy or borrow the DVDs.
Oh, yeah, DVDs.
Right? And there was that additional level of expense that kept people from doing it. But as you point out, if like your office mate was really into Game of Thrones in season 6, you could go home, and if you had HBO, watch the whole thing and catch up, which probably also helped. So it may have been the first blockbuster of the bingeable streaming era.
I think that's true. And I think also the cast is brilliant in this show. I think that, you know, we talk so much about Benioff and Weiss as the writers, and they've been getting so much of the heat and or praise for this final season. But the casting, the fact that all those child actors turned out to be as good as they are
yeah.
10 years later, that's not a given.
Yeah, I've always marveled about that.
They're
in regard
brilliant.
To Harry Potter as well.
Right.
They didn't screw
yeah.
any of that up. But you're right. Although, you know what's funny, and I think about this preview too much. So I don't know, everybody knows that what we saw, episode 1, Winter is Coming, season 1, was the second pilot. That Benioff and Weiss had shot a first pilot, they showed it to some friends of theirs, their friends were like, this is terrible, or the quote was, you have a serious problem. And so they went back to HBO and they said, hey, sorry, we need to do it again. And HBO said, well, we've already given you $11 million, here's another $7. Of course, it turned out to be a good investment. But what I think about is one of the things they did was they recast about half the principal roles. Khaleesi.
And we still don't know.
I checked, because it's 2019, it's the internet, people have figured certain things out,
uh-huh.
like you can find some names. And I think about those actors. Oh, also they brought in a different director. And I think about those actors, and I think about that director, who were on this thing. They had it. And then they were booted off. And for the last 10 years, they've watched these unknowns. It was Emile Clarke's first acting job, Isaac Hempstead Wright's first acting job, Maisie Williams' first acting job, probably the first acting job for...
one of the
Kit
first
Harington
for John
Scotty.
Bradley and Kit
yeah,
Harington,
exactly.
too,
yeah.
among the first.
And they're
yeah.
now
well,
international
yeah.
superstars. And somewhere, there's a half dozen actors sitting in their house just, I don't know what they're thinking, but I feel bad for them, whoever they might be.
I mean, the fact, too, that Sean Bean was one of the only super well-known actors in that first season, and then to have him offed
yeah.
in episode 9, you know, I think then everybody's like, what is
somebody,
this?
Somebody found him and said, well, how do you feel about not being part of the show anymore? And he said, I feel fine. They paid me, and he had another beer, because that's Sean Bean.
What about, should we do least favorite moments?
Least favorite moments.
Least
Go on,
favorite?
Greta. Clearly you want to do that.
I'm don't necessarily. I'm at peace with this show.
Really?
At this point in time, yeah.
Yeah. See, one of my least favorite moments, of course, was one of your favorites with Arya and Sansa.
Oh, right.
At the trial of Littlefinger. But yeah. If you've heard the podcast, you know it's not because I didn't want them to get rid of Littlefinger.
The
it's because I thought that they cheated on the lead up, that they were scheming the whole time, but they didn't show us that. They showed us fighting.
Yeah.
So therefore, cheating. I was thinking about this, and I think all of my favorite moments were the ones that were really great payoffs of stuff that had been built before.
Oh, yeah.
So one of my very favorites was something I just flashed on. I realized how cool it was. In the sequence in which Arya is being chased by the Waif, which I think lasts two episodes. And so they're in the final thing, and she's wounded, and she runs away, and the Waif is chasing her like the Terminator. Like, you know, Arya's running, and the Waif's just walking. Ha ha, I got you. And she gets back to her little hidey hole, like where she's been staying under in like some sort of little crypt. And the Waif walks in, and Arya picks up her sword and goes whoosh, and whiffs out the candle, plunging it into dark. And you're like, oh yeah! Because of course you realize she's blinded by the house of black and white. So she's good at this.
In the dark.
Yes, I thought that was very cool. Anything that something was a huge payoff. Just made me happy. Like, we had been building up to this, and boom.
So for me, that would then include, in that vein, Jamie knighting Brienne.
Yes.
Oh,
probably.
Yeah.
In the most recent season. There's
recency bias, but still, that was one of the great moments.
And especially because,
really
in the rewatch, sort of in between the weeks, realizing that they had spent so much time together that I'd forgotten.
Yeah.
Because it was so long ago, and, you know, you kind of remember the big, gory moments from the show, but forget some of the smaller ones. I'd forgotten that he saved her life on multiple occasions, including from a bear.
Yes, and some rapists and a bear. And also, and this was an interesting choice, that in the books, because their point of view, you get the interior thoughts of all the characters. So, for example, I believe at one point, Jamie, in like either book two or book three, I think book three, starts remembering what actually happened at the sack of King's Landing when he killed the Mad King. All right. Well, what do? You have to have it in dialogue. Who does he tell that to? He tells it to Brienne. So they actually use that relationship to sort of bring out Jamie's character, which is why I think it was so affecting.
Yeah. I'm still mad at Jamie, though.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I think that relationship would have been so much more interesting if they had never had sex.
Yeah, well, I think we all agreed upon that.
Like,
why
I
did
think
that
that's
bother
kind of
us so much?
Because
we talked a little bit about it.
We did.
Were other people bothered by that? That they
there
moaned?
Is nodding.
Like, I think it would have been even more meaningful if they had just been good friends.
Yeah.
And she had, you know, maybe tried to bring out the best in him, and he turned out to be the way he was, and that was fine, you know?
I think it's because I'm going out on a limb here, but all of us are aware that on some level that you tell yourself you like somebody sometimes when all you really want to do is bone them. You know, we've all been there. Oh, wow, she's just such an amazing conversationalist. And she also looks really good in that dress. And so...
Oh, dear. Is this a...
Wisdom of the ages, wrapped up in the body of a short, bald game show host.
The point being,
they don't really deter him, but we have to use them anyway.
It's great.
Oh, you see, because you use them too much. I no longer fear them.
Yeah,
I've become immune.
Jokes.
I've evolved to become immune.
I'm a super bug.
Exactly. I'm an antibiotic
like MRSA?
Resistant germ.
MRSA patriarchy.
Exactly. The point is that when they when it turns out that they had like wanted to bone and wanted to do it the whole time, it kind of cheapened their regard for each other.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. They could have just mutually respected each other, and
exactly.
That would have been lovely.
Yeah.
Okay, so...
we didn't talk about this on the podcast, so I wanted to bring it up.
Oh, Brienne in the end of the finale.
When we did the last episode, we didn't talk about Brienne's entry into the White Book.
Yes.
Into the Wikipedia of Westeros.
A lot of people were upset about that because they didn't like the fact that after he had, like, revealed himself as a fuckboy...
Thank you.
...that she was still affectionate and stood up for him and wrote down that nice thing about him when she should have realized that he wasn't good enough for her, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
I actually kind of liked it. He's dead.
That she wrote... Yeah.
There's nothing...
She's
no vengeance to be had. Why not forgive him?
Yeah, but I again, still think that scene would have been even better if she didn't have to forgive him for being a fuckboy and just forgave him for being a complicated person who had a really weird relationship with his sister. Yeah. You know? I think it would have been even lovelier. But, yeah.
Yeah, maybe you're right.
I think they had referenced that book and Jamie's lack of an entry in it so many times. It was one of the loose ends that they wrapped up in the finale that I wasn't really clamoring for, but it was nice to see. And I think that the last sentence, he died protecting his queen, was like Brienne's way of just paying respect to somebody who made a choice that she understood in her own way, because yeah. she did very irrational things for duty all the time.
Totally. To put it mildly. When we're talking about favorite moments, we always have to remember anything with Diana Rigg.
Yes.
With Olenna Tyrell. One of the things that I discovered when I was a playwright and screenwriter, this was a long time ago, is the best characters are the ones who can say anything.
Yeah.
And the reason, it turns out that a lot of times, I did this once, the reason they can say anything is they're just old and they don't give a shit.
Yeah.
And she was the quintessence of that character.
She was so good.
I
the Queen
loved
of
her.
Thorns.
So because we are not only at the end of season 8, but also the end of the whole damn show, something we've done in the past as we wrap up seasons is do superlatives for different characters, kind of yearbook style.
It so, is yearbook you know, season.
Yeah, like, you know, most likely to succeed, best couple, biggest class clown. So we have each prepared our responses to some of these categories, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay, we
Should
have.
We do it?
Yes.
All right, we're starting with class clown. What do you got, Peter?
I wrote it down. Well, it's got to be Bronn.
Yeah,
Bronn had more punchline. I mean, I don't think he ever said anything that wasn't leading up to a punchline.
I actually went with Qyburn, because I think he's the weirdest guy
That's
in the whole Seven Kingdoms.
So clowns in, like, the shiversy, creepy way.
Yeah, because I'm a little afraid of clowns, so I went with a real creep.
Well, that's good. That's
he's
really
the class
good.
Clown, like Jeffrey Dahmer was the class clown.
But he's like the one who in science class would be doing something inappropriate with the Bunsen burner.
Yeah.
Okay.
She's right.
I'm glad I didn't attend your high school. I don't know what to say.
Okay, best couple, Trisha.
I went with my favorite bromance, so I went Jon and Tormund.
Oh, that's beautiful. Aww.
As like a pair, as a duo?
Yeah.
They're my favorite duo.
Yeah. I said Brienne and Podrick.
That's a good one.
That's a good one. I went with Jaime and Cersei.
Really?
I'll tell you, because first of all, I was trying to think, first of all, is there a loving, there have been a number of loving couples in the show. There's not a single one that didn't end up with at least one of them dead, right?
At least in this case, they died together.
At least, but in this case, first of all, they lasted longer than anybody else.
That's for any other couple,
Nobody murdered the other. As
cradle
in,
to grave, literally.
Exactly, cradle. Very much so. Womb to tomb. But yeah, if you think about it, two couples, Tyrion and Shay, Tyrion kills Shay, Jon and Dany, Jon kills Dany. So on the scale of Game of Thrones romantic relationships, Cersei and Jaime at least were together to the end.
That's disgusting.
But also they are kind of that couple in high school, right? That's like too intense.
Yeah.
That maybe would get called out in the yearbook is like, they're together.
Yeah.
They are together.
Yeah. And usually that's such a positive thing.
Right?
Yeah. No.
Life of the party.
I went with Lady Olenna.
Nice.
Because she will have her cheese and she will have it now.
Yeah.
It will be served when she wants.
What do you got, Peter?
I went with Ser Dantos because he worked so hard during his brief job as a jester. I've been there in front of a crowd. Nobody's laughing, but you keep doing it anyway. So I wanted to throw him a little bone.
Nice. I chose Tormund. Because that
he's fun to have around.
Nasty ass goat's milk is really something.
He really is bad at drinking out of cups and horns, though, without getting it all over his face.
And I respect that.
That's the kind of person who, like, you don't want to invite him to a party at your house.
No. You could go to his house.
Yeah, but, like, he's going to wreck your carpet.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
When Tormund comes to say goodbye to your cleaning deposit, it's gone.
Most changed.
Ooh, that's very thoughtful. I mean, the obvious answer is Sansa.
Yeah, that's
right.
Who I have.
But I wanted to get away from that, so I couldn't decide, but I'm just going to say, not Dany.
Okay.
Yeah.
What do you have?
I went with the Hound or Peter.
Peter Segal?
This
Why?
Peter. Because I feel like you've really learned from the patriarchy jingles over the years.
That's actually really nice, Trisha. I wish we had a little award.
For me.
For this man
what
here.
What would it be like in the end of Wizard of Oz where you give me like a diploma that's like I'm really smart? You give me like something to prove that I've learned about the patriarchy?
Less annoying comments. I mean, there's still some, but well, I think there are fewer than there were in the beginning.
I have to stay on brand, Greta.
But the Hound, you know, we meet him as like a total, you know, bloodthirsty mercenary.
That's true,
runs
yeah.
down the baker's boy, and then he ends by basically saving Arya's life
yeah.
and convincing her to walk away. So I think that that character and that relationship is one of my favorites.
Okay, what about most likely to succeed?
Well, it's got to be Bran, right? And you know he's going to figure out a way to have kids anyway. He's not going to let a mere sort of spinal injury stop him.
I went with Arya Stark because
yeah.
the capacity to steal faces,
yeah.
which was not used enough in the show, one
yes.
of my continuous gripes. There uh-huh. is some knee-slapping in the audience of agreement, and I appreciate it.
that
because it's
oh,
a
wow.
Yes.
Yeah.
It was a fantastic thing that she worked really hard to be able to do, and then she only got to do it once. So
yeah.
I hope she
well,
gets to do it
twice.
A bunch more times. Yeah, true.
Yeah, she did it once to
right.
kill Walder Frey, and
yeah,
then she
yeah,
killed
yeah.
everybody else using Walder Frey.
I think the realm is most likely to succeed.
Oh, that's Aww. Optimistic.
Right?
Really? You think that Bran is going to be a wise and benevolent
yeah.
king, and Sansa is going to rule the North
yeah.
in a
Yeah, I think that was the whole deal, right? And
yeah.
the wildlings get to chill with Jon.
They're,
like,
they're gonna be,
everybody wins.
Everybody's cool.
Yeah.
You know something's going to go wrong.
Well, maybe not, though. Like, maybe we can just let it be exactly what it is, and that's
Why
totally fine,
not?
You know?
Absolutely.
More from our Game of Thrones series recap, recorded live at the Apple Store in Chicago right after this break.
Spinoffs. Trisha, what's spinoff news?
Yeah.
Do you know it?
So I've been reading the internets, as I do.
Yeah.
The head of HBO seems the most sort of assuring that one of the prequels will happen. It's been sort of ordered up to pilot. They say they're taking their time. Naomi Watts is attached. It's supposedly set very, very long ago in the same world that we know from the books. Many other things have been talked about as being in development. George R. R. Martin has said there are several projects that are moving along quite nicely, but those are in earlier stages of development. And in the most recent sort of post-finale episode with the head of HBO, they did talk about the fact that they want to give the prequel like space to breathe and not just bombard people with like four more shows about Game of Thrones and try to milk it.
Well, and they were also pretty clear that they're not doing anything with Arya.
There's not like Arya in the Americas or anything
Arya
like
goes
that.
Arya goes west.
Yeah. Like Feifel goes west?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh my God. Is it a musical?
So you that. Would watch a prequel, right?
Yeah, I would absolutely give it a try. And I'm also excited that the success of the show has spawned so many other potential things
yeah,
in development.
Totally.
So like there's a giant list of those.
Yes, yes. We'll get to that. Peter, would you watch a prequel?
I'm going to.
You're going to.
Whether I want to or not, I'm
okay.
going to.
So before we get to other shows, I think we should talk a little bit about the books. Because we're in this very interesting situation where the TV series is over. We had
yep.
eight seasons. The book series was supposed to be seven books. We have five. The last one came out in 2011. George R. R. Martin has written books since. He published a very hefty History of the Targaryens, which came out just about 6 months ago.
That
right.
nobody asked for.
Yes.
Which nobody
but
asked
people
for.
People apparently enjoyed.
So what do you think? If you had asked me 2 years ago, I would have said he had no incentive to finish the books.
No.
Given the success of the TV series.
No, he has no incentive.
And I have changed my mind since.
How so? Well, are you part of the school that believes that since Benioff and Weiss, quote, screwed up the ending, unquote,
no.
that now Martin has this incentive to show us all how it's done?
I mean,
done?
I do think he has more of an incentive to write them because fans are so dissatisfied. I don't think Benioff and Weiss, like, screwed it up, but I do think, you know, I think there are a lot of people, I mean, we even got listener emails saying, well, we don't know for sure if this happened because it's not canon.
Right.
You know, I mean, the book nerds are still the book nerds.
God bless them.
And
God bless us.
I was recently hanging out with a friend who owns a bookstore here in town, and she's got this amazing
Plug
theory.
It.
It's called Volumes. It's in Wicker Park. It's amazing. Rebecca, I hope she doesn't mind that I'm outing her, but I'm doing it. She thinks that he has already written the books, and HBO asked him not to publish them.
You know that he addressed that on his
yeah,
blog.
Yeah, but
said,
I mean,
he said, why would I do that?
And
he
also,
said,
if that was true, this week would have been when we would have found out a release date for at least the sixth, if not both the sixth and seventh books.
I don't know.
So this conspiracy theory is officially dead.
I just love it so much. I'm not giving up on it yet. I think there's still a possibility.
I don't think he's ever going to finish it.
The thing is, like, what about the people 20 years from now who start reading the books and then, what, like, if they want to know what happens, they have to watch this 20-year-old TV show that I'm sure is just going to seem super dated by
then? I'm sorry for them, but I don't think he's ever going to write it. I mean, here's the thing, and this comes from mainly my own experience of being a writer back when I was writing plays. And in order, first of all, there's so many more fun things to do than write. And George R. R. Martin can spend his day giving interviews, enjoying his money, attending panels where people applaud, getting awards. All of those things are so much more fun than writing. And the second, he runs a movie theater, he produces TV
shows.
Yeah, but
he's got to be taking shit all the time.
Well, a general pattern, there are people like Stephen King who never fall trapped to this, but other people like, you know, there are screenwriters who become producers because it's so much more fun to produce than actually try to write stuff. But the other problem is, and I've experienced this, when you sit down to write fiction, you have to shut everything out and let the characters tell you what they're going to do. And that's very much what he did.
Right.
He, as we all remember, had been a fiction writer his whole life. He went out to Hollywood. He worked on TV. He wrote on Beauty and the Beast. In fact, he has a cameo. I was watching it, and, like, there he was. and then he got really frustrated because he kept wanting to do these things, and the TV executives said, "Oh, we can't afford it. We can't have a big battle. We can't have horses. What are you talking about?" So he said, fuck it, and he went back home to Santa Fe, and he basically shut the door, and he just went inside his mind to his own world, and he found his characters, and he wrote them exactly the way he wanted, and that's basically the first three books. How in the world can you go back to that space when Tyrion isn't yours anymore? He's the world, and he's Peter Dinklage, and he's David Benioff. He's Benioff and Weiss's. The one of my biggest disappointments in life was reading the novel Hannibal, which was the sequel to Silence of the Lambs.
Which you loved.
I love Silence of the Lambs. I think it's one of the greatest books ever written in terms of, like, its technical precision and expertise.
You assigned that as homework on Nerdette.
We
interviewed you. What was that, like
2,700 years ago?
Yeah, I know. It's a great book, and I was so excited, and I bought it in hardcover, and I read it, and it was terrible. And I think one of the reasons it was terrible was because Thomas Harris was saying, fuck you, to the entire world that thought they knew his character, and therefore he made his characters do ridiculous things.
Sure.
Like, in the end of the novel Hannibal, Clarice Starling marries Hannibal Lecter.
Vito.
Which, yes. And it was clear that was such a reaction to the fact that he had become this iconic character, and Thomas Harris was like, I'm going to show you who owns his character. And I think that's impossible to avoid if you're someone like George R. R. Martin, and I think it'll be easier just not to do it.
Fair enough.
He's got thousands of pages written, it sounds like, though. It's just a matter of, you know, I mean, as somebody who, by trade, edits other people, I'm going to say he needs a good editor.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that, like, to expect him alone, he's joked about sort of, like, his staff chaining him to a typewriter and making him eat healthy foods because he's, like, not a young man, and people are counting on him to do this work.
I should say, and this is because I'm no longer the patriarchal asshole I used to, there's another person who avoided this trap very skillfully and bravely, and that was J.K. Rowling.
Right.
Because the movies were coming out before she was finished with the novels, and yet she stayed to her vision the whole way through.
Well, and, you know, I think...
And she had a clear and sort
knew
of
what was
truly charted.
Yeah. I think that helped a lot.
Yeah.
I think also, I mean, she escaped a lot of that by writing under a pseudonym after Harry Potter was over, too.
And completely changing genres.
Yeah.
Which is also
and
true.
Those are
I mean,
excellent.
She's never. I mean,
so I want to talk about the different shows that are optioned because there's a whole bunch of them. But first, I want to recommend, speaking of book series, two series. They are both trilogies. They have been completed. They are amazing. One is called The Broken Earth Trilogy. It's by N.K. Jemisin.
I read the first book.
She won the Hugo Award for each of the three books in that series because she is so goddamn good.
She is smart.
The second series I'd like to recommend is called The Shades of Magic series. It's by V.E. Schwab. And she recently, like, just was hanging out with Neil Gaiman this week, if you need to know her nerd cred. She is awesome. There's a lady pirate. It's amazing. You're going to love it. Read them.
And they are complete, so you cannot...
They are complete. There are three books.
Yep.
They exist in the world. There are great audiobooks.
I'm going to recommend... I recommended this, actually. I don't remember if it was on Nerdette or it was on this podcast. But I recently picked them up and started rereading them because I was afraid. I had recommended them to a friend, and I was afraid, are they as good as I remember? They are. The Patrick O'Brien novels about the early British Navy with Aubrey and Maturin are fantastic.
Wait, that's what our friend Al Keefe likes, right?
Yeah, one of our dearest friends is obsessed with those books.
Yes, they actually are fantastically
just
good.
Just asked me if I would do a podcast about those, and I was like, isn't that like boats and stuff?
It's
I
boats
don't know.
And stuff, but it's like, it's so fantastically good. The writing and the character. I mean,
and there are what, dozens of those?
Yeah,
there's 23.
There are dozens of us.
Yeah, but they're fantastically good, and they're good in somewhat of the same way that Game of Thrones or anything we all love is that the characters seem real in a way that characters in fiction don't often.
Yeah. So let's talk about the TV shows.
Yes, because I'm not likely to read any of those, as you know.
Right. Right.
There's too much to read on the internet. We can't stop with books.
Yes. I read the internet, and then I watch the television, and then I read the internet about the television. So Amazon, again, has ordered up several of these sort of beloved series to TV shows. The one that is probably, is either going to be the greatest or the biggest disappointment is the Lord of the Rings show.
Yeah.
So now, are they doing the trilogy story?
They're not doing the story. They're doing sort of new fiction set in the second age of Middle-earth.
Right.
I don't know how I feel about that one.
Well, I'm going to suspend my judgment. Of course, I'm thinking, I know the second age.
Yeah.
Well, okay. And they're also doing that Wheel of Time series, right?
Yes. Well, I will say, though, about the Lord of the Rings series, that Brian Cogman, who's one of the head writers and
producers
from Game of Thrones, just signed on recently to the Lord of the Rings show. So that's a good sign.
Dang.
And then the Dark Tower series from the King books has also been ordered up by Amazon. And then the Wheel of Time series. Again, Amazon's sort of placing at least three big bets on
this
genre.
Which is what, Robert Jordan,
Robert Jordan books.
There's like 16 of those, which just feels like too many.
And famously, he died before he finished, which is why everybody's so freaked about George R. R. Martin. There's no guarantee that any of those are going to be any good.
Right. Well, yeah, there's no guarantee that anything's ever going to be good.
That's true.
That's the delight of
living
in the world.
Well, I think there is a guarantee that his Dark Materials is going to be good because it has Lin-Manuel Miranda in
it. Yeah, he's playing Lee Scoresby. I'm so excited about that.
I just don't want to get my heart broken because my heart was broken so badly by that terrible movie.
Well, yeah, but, you know, that was a long time ago. The source material is good.
Yeah.
We know that.
Yeah. But have you guys read His Dark Materials by Philip Pullman?
So this is another trilogy. The first one is called The Golden Compass. It's a YA series. It came out in, like, I think the first one came out in 95?
Yeah, my favorite thing, it's fantastically good by a British author named Philip Pullman, with one of the most amazing heroine of all time, Lyra of Oxford.
Yes.
But the great thing about it is, remember, some of you look old enough, when Harry Potter was being published, there was this reaction among the evangelical Christian community saying it's satanic.
I actually lived next to
a charismatic Christian family, and this daughter loved Harry Potter, and then one day she didn't talk about Harry Potter anymore because her mother decided they were satanic, which was bullshit because Harry Potter is not satanic. His Dark Materials is satanic.
Yeah. For real,
Satan,
like angels and all that
angel,
good stuff.
There's like God is the villain and Satan is the hero. And, you know, it's not immediately apparent, but that's the case. And I just love the fact that the people who go on about those things were too dumb to realize that.
We're also getting a Narnia show from Netflix.
Yes.
And the Kingkiller Chronicles.
The Kingkiller Chronicles, produced by Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Yeah, right. So maybe music in this show. That could be very exciting.
And
these are the Patrick Rothfuss books.
And that's also an incomplete series. Bless you.
Yeah, and Patrick Rothfuss, who I've met,
of those.
Patrick Rothfuss has gotten really into being famous as well.
Yeah.
So I don't know if he's ever going to finish.
There's also Netflix is doing The Witcher, which I don't know anything about except that it's a video game that people like.
It was novels first, then it became a video game, and now it's going to be a TV series.
And Netflix is also doing an Arthurian legend situation called Cursed, which I think sounds kind of cool.
Yeah.
I like King Arthur stuff.
Well, I am most excited about His Dark Materials, in part because
it's
like imminent and actually happening.
Yeah.
Some of these other things
are
in development.
But we don't know when. They haven't given a release date
yet.
But
2019, they say. So probably later this year.
Right. Okay. I mean, there have actually already been some sword and sorcery or medieval set TV series that have come and gone already.
Totally.
Because of Game of Thrones. Because it's really hard to do, especially if you think that dragons or magic or swords or guys in armor is going to be the secret to your success, because it's just not.
Yeah. So what do you think? Should we do some audience questions?
Yeah.
Do you all have questions you want to ask us?
Questions or comments?
And if you have a question or a comment, I'm definitely looking for recommendations for how to fill the Game of Thrones-shaped hole in my heart.
Oh, yeah.
I'm
going
to try to read some books. There's somebody right here in front.
I would just like to comment about the pronunciation of Sansa.
Uh-huh.
Am I getting it wrong?
Say it with me.
Sansa. And I say Sansa. Yeah.
I think I might too, actually.
This is because I'm from New Jersey. I just want to tell you, I'll just...
Say it with me.
My wife, who I just married and we're deeply in love, her name is Mara, M-A-R-A, and I call her Mara all the time. In fact, this is a true story.
But you correct us.
The patriarchy speaking, so ladies be quiet. Peter Sagal is the worst.
I don't do it intentionally.
Well, you didn't say that.
I mean, I don't like do it to torment her. I do it because I'm a dork. I mean, the true story, on the day I proposed, she fainted. Dead away. And I'm standing there on a beach with an engagement ring in my pocket going, Mara? Mara? And she says she came back from, like, the realm, like, before she crossed the border into the land of the dead, just to correct me. It's like, it's Mara, you son of a bitch. And so now
she's
we're
she's great.
And yes.
We love her.
All right. Our next question is from Scott.
Hey, Scott.
Hi, I just wanted to have suggest another show. Next month, Netflix is going to be showing Neon Genesis Evangelion.
Oh, wow.
Which is a critically acclaimed anime series.
Yeah.
The Game of Thrones connection is that the last two episodes were so universally hated that they replaced them with a movie.
Wow,
no, really?
I forgot about that.
So the movie sort of picks up where the third to last episode and finishes it again in a different way?
The movie is literally split into episodes 25 and 26.
Damn.
And so this is an anime series from Japan?
Yes.
And so they've translated into English,
yes.
And wow, that's weird.
What an insightful
Is the show good? Is it worth watching?
I've heard it's great.
Well, I love giant monsters.
Wow.
Okay. All right.
That's fascinating.
That is fascinating.
Good rec.
Do we have other questions?
Oh, got here. Another question up here, also from Scott.
Oh, hey, Scott.
Thank you, Scott, for attending.
What's the genesis of this Peter Sagal patriarchal thing?
Oh, what? So
you mean other than the patriarchy?
I guess.
How did it start? I mean, for reasons lost in memory, I was the guy who commissioned them.
Yeah.
Because Paul and Storm are good friends of mine, and I called them up and I said, could you do this first? But I don't remember what led to that.
I mean, we got some early anecdotal feedback and some early... Apple Podcast reviews that said for people who were fans of the show Nerd at Proper, which was the two of us talking often with other women, but also with men as guests, that you know we had ceded perhaps too much of the conversation to the man who had joined us for these recaps, and so as a very intentionally feminist show, our fans were worried that we were letting Peter talk too much.
Well, because partly what it was that we put it in the first, when we recapped season 5, we put it in the Nerdette podcast feed. And we weren't super clear about hey guys, Nerdette is still a thing where we talk to people and do fun, cool, feministy things. And so then all of a sudden, Peter just showed up and talked at us about Game of Thrones. And I think especially in those early episodes, we were still a little awestruck, oh my God, this is Peter Sagal. We did get over that quickly. But yeah, here we were, we grew up listening to Wait, Wait, and he's in the studio next to us, and it's like, yeah, of course, we'll let you talk. That's fine.
I have a vague memory of somebody actually, I don't remember who it was, it was probably Trisha, saying we need some sort of jingle to play when you get all patriarchal.
I bet it was Trisha's idea.
It was something like that. It's the sort of thing you would say.
And then you had friends who made
said,
it real.
What a great idea.
Yeah.
And then once we had them, we were drunk with power.
Well, I mean, I also remember very distinctly being in the WBEZ staff kitchen and chatting with Miles Dornboss, who is a producer for Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And he said, and it was very early days, and he just said, Peter is at his best when he's in the corner. And I think...
What did he mean by that?
you can be very charming when we make fun of you, and otherwise you're kind of obnoxious, is how I took that. It's like, that's when you're your best, is when we're mocking you.
I just took it to mean that you've been conditioned by Paula Poundstone for years to take a lot of sass.
I do enjoy it.
I think the patriarchy jingle was sort of like the first device that we were able to use to, before I was comfortable enough, just mercilessly mocking you.
They're just meant for a little bit of fun.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a great question.
You know, I'm gonna suggest to Paul and Storms, and so many people liked them, that they de-customize them and do versions without my name.
People
or
have
references
asked for
to
that.
Me, so that people can use them in any social situation where you need one.
Right?
Yeah. I have called one on myself before. So, like, they can be used in a gender-neutral way if you really want
to.
The,
you know, we've all embodied the patriarchy in our own ways.
How many minutes has it been since Peter's mentioned Harvard? What a colossal tool.
That man is a friend of mine.
Oh, that one is really harsh. That one is really harsh.
Anybody else?
We have one back here from Carson.
Awesome.
Hey, guys. Long-time listener, first-time caller. Hey.
You are a staff member.
Yes, that's true.
I see the green shirt on you.
Not anymore.
Okay.
Currently off the clock. Exactly.
Fair enough.
Okay, so I know we kind of already talked about this, but, you know, last episode, Tyrion's got that line where he's like, ask me again in 10 years.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Do you think they're going to pull a Twin Peaks in like 10 years?
Zip like, forward?
Yeah, whoa. Come on, guys. Let's get it back. The gang's back together.
No.
I hope not.
Yeah, I think that was actually, that was in a problematic ending. That was one of my favorite bits because he's right. There's no way of knowing. You know, is this going to work out? Would, you know, better than Dany would have worked out with her Reign of Terror? I don't know. So it seemed like a very kind of strangely realistic ending for a TV show.
I mean, it's also kind of a self-aware way of being like, we have no idea. Like, we gave it our best shot, and we hope you like it. Here you go.
It's also a show that's so vast that it's a little harder to reboot than, like, Friends or Will and Grace, which are set in like a soundstage that's very simple to get the band back together.
We need to borrow Northern Ireland again.
Yeah. How about those ruins? Any other questions?
We have one from Steve.
Hey, Steve.
So my question is if you could change perhaps one thing within the, you know, the final portion of the season, whether it be in the production or the plot or anything like that, what would it be and why?
I want the Night King to have a Bond villain-esque monologue where we find out what his deal was. I mean, I don't want that because it actually would have not been better than what happened in the show, but
trash.
I desperately wanted
in your mind,
that to
Trisha,
have a point.
What might that monologue have been like?
Oh, it would have been terrible, but at least then we would have known what the point of the White Walkers
but
were.
But can you suppose a point? Can you say, I think that he was interested in... Do you know?
I don't know.
Okay,
and that's why I'm so angry.
But they're,
you know, the fact that they were stealing babies, why, if they didn't have a culture or a civilization?
Well, they were making White Walkers. That seemed pretty obvious.
Why? Why did he need more White Walkers if he just used the Army of the Dead to create destruction? Why did he need, like, peers? Why didn't
you have to have someone to talk to.
Well, so there's something more than we know about him.
Okay. Can't imagine what they talked about. Yeah, these guys smell.
Got to have somebody to play poker with? Like, why did he, you know, there's things that are unanswered.
I gave mine in the last podcast briefly. I thought John should die. I thought that there's that whole thing of, like, why did they leave John alive when they just executed some prisoners for something much less offensive than killing the queen? And I think the answer to that dilemma was that John kills Dany knowingly at the cost of his own life. Because he knows he's not going to survive having done that. And I suggested a dramatic way to do that. And I found out, I'm going to brag, Ira Glass wrote to me and said, I think that's a good idea. And I'm like, Ira Glass listens to... Anyway. Because I think that what it lacked was a sacrifice. Somebody doing something incredibly selfless. Which I think provides for good endings in general.
And we talked about this a little bit too. I think one element of that, even if he hadn't died, was if we were actually convinced that John and Dany loved each other, that would
that
also...
That ship had sailed, though.
I mean, obviously, that ship, good one. But yeah, I think if they had really seemed like they actually loved each other and he still knew that she was crazy and he had to kill her, I think that would have been a lot more powerful too.
But they tried so hard to sell that, especially if you went... I rewatched season 7 before this season, and there are so many beats in that season that were all about, look what Danny's doing for John. Look what John's doing for Dany. Look how they're establishing trust. Look how they're establishing intimacy. Look how they're looking at each other. Look how cute they are. Of course they're going to fall in love.
Yeah.
And I didn't buy it for a second.
Which is, you know, I think you've seen Fleabag, right?
Oh, yeah. I haven't seen season 2 yet.
You haven't seen season 2. So Fleabag is this excellent show... written and starring this woman named Phoebe Waller-Bridge. There are 6 episodes in the second season, and each one is half an hour long, and she ends up entangled in this relationship with someone.
Don't spoil it.
And that's all I'll say about it. But like the sexual tension is so intense. And it's over 3 hours. And it's, you know, it was just interesting to watch it right after finishing Game of Thrones. Yeah, because it's like,
it can be
done. It is possible. And it's not that, like, you don't, it feels like something that we're told a lot in radio journalism, which is show, don't tell. And I felt like they kept trying to tell us that John and Danny were in love with each other, but exactly. We were never actually shown
because they
that.
Needed it to happen, and it didn't happen organically.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think the other thing I would change, I've already complained about, which is Jamie and Brienne.
Yeah.
I think, you know, like, so much about this show over the course of the 8 seasons is, it's about relationships.
The friends we make along the way.
The friends we make along the way, and I think they could have, if those two had been different, I would have been a lot more emotionally invested, I think. But everybody should watch Fleabag, by the way.
Yeah, Fleabag. Fleabag is astoundingly good. And if you liked Killing Eve, yeah. Phoebe Waller-Bridge wrote season 1 of Killing Eve. And Fleabag is better.
It is. And it turns out Killing Eve is based on some books, which are not bad either. I've been listening to those.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
It was not a dismissive okay.
Any other questions? Is that it? Well, thanks all of you.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you all for coming out. We'll see you with Unity. We can think of something else to talk about.
Oh my God, I can't believe it's over, though I have to admit, as you're probably unsurprised to hear, I am a bit relieved about it. Anyway, if you love this show, you should try out Nerdette. Peter isn't in it at all. You're probably going to love it. You could start with an episode with author Margaret Atwood. She is a bad bitch. And hey, we have a pretty fun newsletter. You can sign up for it on our Facebook page. There's a blue sign up button. Just click on that and put your little email address in there. The show is produced by us with help from Justin Bull. Our executive producer is Brendan Banaszak. Special thanks to Nora Semmel and all the employees at the Apple Store on Michigan Avenue in Chicago. Our theme music was composed by Andrew Edwards of Blue Police Box Music. And an epic Westerosi high five to Paul and Storm. They are the creators of the amazing patriarchy jingles, and we are so glad they exist in the world. As a special thanks to them, we're going to play every single patriarchy jingle they have ever made. You're welcome.
The wisdom of the ages, wrapped up in the body of a short, bald game show host. Blah, 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 whatever. Peter, nobody cares. He's the best Jewish male public radio host when you can't afford Ira Glass. How many minutes has it been since Peter's mentioned Harvard? What a colossal tool. He's Rhaegar in the streets and Varys in the sheets. He's Peter Sagal. Gather round and listen while old Peter Sagal mansplains this show to you. Nobody cares, but it never really stops him. Is Peter still fucking talking? If Peter's opinion falls in the forest, does anybody give a shit? Everybody quiet, cause Peter Sagal's got another goddamn opinion. I can't believe that I'm about to say these words aloud. I agree with Peter. The rhetorical equivalent of stray cat vomit. Peter Sagal's thoughts on art. The patriarchy speaking, so ladies be quiet. Peter Sagal is the worst.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.